Psalm 52 is a meditation on the behavior and destiny of those who do evil and those who do good. They boast of the evil that they have the power to do, but, says the psalmist, they'll be uprooted from their tent by God. This is in stark contrast to those who are faithful to the covenant. They trust in God and are like a fruitful olive in God's house. We recall Jesus' words, "You cannot serve God and wealth." The first verse of Psalm 52 is interesting because scholars disagree as to how to translate it. It's in fact ambiguous. And it's because of the use of the word chesed, or it might be chasid. You need to remember that Hebrew is a consonantal language. There are no vowels in the alphabet. So when you have the ch and the s and the d together, is it chesed? Is it chasid? It might be ambiguous. In this case, for example, one could translate the first verse, "O mighty one," meaning person who thinks you've got a lot of power. It goes, "Why do you boast of God's kindness, God's chesed, and do evil?" That's a possible translation. Or, "Why do you boast of evil against the godly," the chasid? Or it could be, this is unusual, but it's possible, the chest, that consonantal group, can also mean insult. That's rare. We find it in Leviticus 20, verse 17, and in Proverbs verse 14, chapter 14, verse 34, having the meaning of insult. So the verse could be translated, "Why do you boast of evil?" And instead of saying against the godly, it might mean "and insult God." Now, all those three sentences make sense in the light of the rest of the psalm. What did the psalmist intend to say? Well, I don't know. But it's one of those unusual situations where a variety of understandings could be possible. It'll be interesting to note that the chesed and the chasid appear later on in the same psalm. So, in any case, it's about the mighty ones, the powerful ones, the ones who run the roost, rule the roost. It's about them and about boasting, and it's about boasting in relation to God and about doing evil. That much is certain. And verse 2 reads, "All day long you're plotting destruction. Your tongue is like a sharp sword, you who deal in deceit. You prefer evil to good and choose to lie in preference to speaking the truth. You love the destructive word, O deceitful tongue." Here a comment is relevant. When we think of moral behavior, it will depend on what society you're in and what the mood is of the day. But I'd say in my youth anyhow, sexual sins were pretty high up on the list. And they should be, because they're about love. They're about how we express love, so they're clearly important. And in the New Testament, Paul often speaks of them at the front of the list of problems that people have for that same reason, that his love is his key focus. But it is interesting to note in the biblical tradition, the Old Testament tradition, where sexual sins are also named, of course, lying is far, far, takes a higher profile. The truth is is seen to be terrifically important. So in this case, verse 3, you prefer evil to good, and then it defines that, you choose to lie in preference to speaking the truth. Immediately it goes into this. Truth is so important because it's about reality. It's about who I am. If I lie, I've lost myself. I'm no longer me. I've, for other reasons of convenience or fear, or I've actually betrayed the essence of who I am. I'm lost. So lying, in a significant, central sense, has a very high profile in the Bible as far as moral behaviour is concerned, the essence of who we are. Read James' letter in the New Testament. It's about the sins committed by the tongue are very central in that. Well, these people who are powerful reckon they can get away with anything. They have no interest in the truth. And we might wonder about the public life today in various institutions. The carelessness with regard to truth is undermining the very essence of who we are as a nation and as a people. So back to verse 5. Very well, he says, God will break you down and remove you forever. Well, that's based on an understanding of God that doesn't fit with the revelation of Jesus. But it was the understanding of a controlling God who would sort everything out in this world that is part of the biblical assumption. In the fullness of time, of course, when we think of heaven and hell, we do suffer the consequences of our behaviour, and we can't avoid them, but they're self-inflicted punishment, not God-inflicted punishment. In any case here, God, who's seen as the controller of the world, he mentions, will break you down and remove you forever. God will snatch you from your tent and uproot you from the land of the living. Jesus uses a similar image when he, using the same metaphor, he says, every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be uprooted. He doesn't say God will uproot them, notice. But they will be uprooted because truth will finally triumph. Good will finally prevail. Heaven is fullness of love. And all evil will ultimately be destroyed. Self-destroyed. Verse 6. The just will see and fear and will laugh at the evildoer, saying, so this is the one who would not take refuge in God, but trusted in the power of wealth and grew powerful through crime. And the psalmist concludes, here am I, like a green olive tree in the house of God. I have always trusted in the chesed, the kindness of God. I will thank you forevermore because of what you've done. And here, in the presence of the faithful, that is the chassid. In this case, it clearly means kindness, and the second time, the faithful ones. Verse 1 we saw could be either. In the presence of the faithful, I hope in your name, for it is good. So it's a psalm encouraging goodness and challenging the power and the lies and the neglect of God that the psalmist sees in those who are seemingly succeeding but will ultimately be destroyed.